WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We're positively going to be taking the Maryland Crab Cake Tour back out on the road, all presented by the Maryland Lottery. I'm going to let myself play beginning on March 4th. We're going to kick it back into gear down at Mama's on the Half Shell, Nacho Mama's next door in Canton, where they do not have the Berea quesadillas, but they do have them uptown at Towson, so go check that out. And I am in deep, deep negotiations, Don Moeller, with Damie Hahn and everyone over at Fadley's, as well as at Pete and Nick at Costas. We're down with Justin and the folks up at Pappas. We're going to be back with Andrea and the folks at Conrad's. So we have places, just going to get spaces and dates, and some of my places have multiple locations. Fadley's going to have a second location in Catonsville soon, right?
They are indeed.
How are you? Before we bring in our esteemed guest and guest this week, I must say this is the first segment we're doing as tanks and soldiers go into Ukraine. It pisses Don and I off. I don't know how we're not going to talk about it, although we stay on local issues here as much. Everyone has an opinion on it. I just want to make sure I sort of set the level straight that this morning the world went to war, and that's probably going to cloud a lot of the things we're talking about, Don.
Oh, absolutely, and I expect that we will be getting from our guest at least their initial reaction, and we have one of the longtime, I always am amazed when I say that, Brian, anymore, one of the deans of government reporting in the state of Maryland, Brian Sears of the Daily Record. Been down there in Annapolis now more than 20 years, I think, Brian. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's about right. I think when you call somebody the dean, that's like saying that they've been able to hold on to a job like grim death for a long period of time.
Put you in Lou Pano's territory.
No, I don't get to be in Lou Pano's territory quite yet.
Well, before we do get into all of the serious stuff talking nationally and locally, anyone who follows you on social media, it's basically a sitcom. And Sam and AJ are the stars. We're talking about twins who are ready to wreak havoc and run all over. Are they not quite a year yet, Brian?
They'll be, they're just a little over 9 months. They'll be a year in May.
And so, ready to take off.
Yeah, I've got one that's crawling backwards and the other one that's up on his knees and rocking back and forth. And Jen and I are playing man-to-man defense, and we might have to bring the dog in on this.
It's a family affair, sounds to me.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, do they sleep?
They do.
I want to know if they sleep.
They do. I've got one that sleeps through the night. He will go to bed about 7:30, 8 o'clock, and sleeps until most days until about 6, 6:30. The other one goes to bed about the same time as his brother and gets up between 5 and 6. But they're generally pretty good sleepers. But the one that sleeps until six, he loves his naps and he loves his meals.
Are they distinct? Last twin question, because
yeah,
folks
sure.
who listen know that I have twin grandbabies who the one and only Declan and Navy, who we refer to as the princess, who just turned six, doesn't seem possible. Incredibly distinct personalities, and those personalities were distinct, Brian. I will tell you, even from the photos in the womb, you could look at those photos, those ultrasounds, and say, uh-oh, you can see who the firecracker's going to be. Do Sam and AJ also have distinct personalities?
They do. AJ is more of he's our chill kid. Nothing rattles him. Nothing bothers him. He's happy all the time. But he's not terribly reactive one way or the other. Sam is our emotional kid. Everything gets an emotional, immediate knee-jerk reaction. He's wickedly happy about something. We've actually seen him a couple of times, like when he can't sort of express what he wants, he goes into what we call Hulk mode, where the hands literally come up and he gets so mad because he can't tell you what he wants. So he's definitely.
My kid was usually pooping when he was doing that, as I remember. But it was 36 years ago, so.
Well, you know what's interesting? I swear, Brian, and you know, you and I have talked to Kay Tamara, our good buddy, who also has twins, and I said my daughter and other.
Dude, I can't imagine. It exhausts me just think. I'm just listening to Brian, and I'm exhausted thinking about it.
Nestor, I don't know how they do it. I've said to each and every one, because they're all professionals. They're all balancing work and parenting. It's remarkable. We watched it up close and personal, and I can't comprehend it. But every set of twins that I know, and I think this is without fail, describes the same personality traits that you're describing. One is the firecracker, the emotional one. The other one is just like the chill, the Dean Martin. You know, I'm going to take it as it comes. It's something there to Twin City. Well, good luck with Sam and AJ, and keep Thanks. The photos coming, Brian. Before we get into all of the state and local issues. And I want to, you got more emotional on Twitter and Facebook than I normally see the other day regarding Juwan Howard. I thought that's an Brian Sears type. So we'll get into that in a moment as well.
Okay.
But before we do, we all woke up today or went to bed late last night, just horrified. Nestor, I think, started with that word. I don't know what other word.
Well, it's dominated my morning, and I'm alone. You know what I mean? And it's not because I'm on Twitter, because I got off, right? I saw it immediately. And then it's just more like trying to get my arms around it, you know? And always the why, right? That's what the intellectuals do. Why? Why? Right?
And you have young – here we go. You've got young babies, 9 months old, looking at a world that today has its, no hyperbole, biggest crisis since World War Two. What's your reaction, both as a dad, a citizen, and a journalist this morning?
Well, I mean, I will say, and you know, I have to be careful because I don't report on these things, but I am a journalist, and so I'm careful about my opinions. But I mean, my first thought last night when I saw the news was, you know, how far does this go? Is this just, you know, none of this is good. But it can be worse. And is this just the start of, you know, an invasion of two regions where there are Russian separatists? Does the leader of Russia have bit larger designs on the entire country? What role does NATO end up playing in this? And we can come back around to this in a second, but also I began to think about what the potential fallout is for elections this year, because I do think that there's potentially some connections here, both nationally and locally.
Can you imagine if we are aligned in the world's cause to invade Ukraine because this creep wins an election again 2 years from now, and somehow these maniacs on Fox News that are pro-Putin turn our flag into something that's pro-Putin? I mean, it's unspeakable. I think about our forefathers that went to war, that fought these wars 100 years ago, 75 years ago, 80 years ago. I'm literally without words to say that this ass clown is on national television every night striking the band up for Putin, and that Russian money is what's at the source of what makes the red hats happen in this country.
Well, yeah, I think that's all has us all scratching our heads as we come on this morning to record our interviews today. Right as I walked into the office, former President Bush released a blistering statement condemning Putin and his actions and standing with President Biden and with NATO. And I think, and again, Brian,
I mean, maybe this is a time for Clinton and Obama and Bush to kind of get together, right? Like, maybe this is one of those moments where we say, we're with Joe and we're not with Vladimir.
Well, that's what I was going to ask Brian. And Brian is notoriously nonpartisan. I don't know.
An independent.
I've known Brian for 30 or plus years, and I truly have no idea. Would not ask him whether he's a Democrat or Republican or independent. I have no idea. He kept us all honest on both sides of the aisle. So he's an equal opportunity
fender
pundit when he goes after us. But Brian, I think Nestor is on to something in that there's something that just feels so discordant about a former president not standing with the current president in a time of international crisis. It's another one of those guardrails that the former president appears to just blow right through.
We're 13 months away from him sending people, you know, up the steps to, you know, into the Capitol, right?
I mean, what's your reaction to that?
I mean, look, I don't know that it's terribly surprising to me. I mean, because we are, it is, you know, the former president has always been very clear about how he has, you know, how he saw the 2020 election. He's been very clear about his feelings about Joe Biden. I mean, if you look at 4 years of how his administration, I mean, he has taken very different tacks on things. And I say that not as someone who's taking a position on it, but I think in that respect, he's been very consistent. And so I'm not sure that any of this is particularly surprising to me.
Yeah, that's really the sad part, right? And Nestor and I
will In other words, there is no bottom.
there's no bottom, and you and I will be exploring it later in the recon and talking more about Mike Pompeo and some of these folks on the right now. And again, I'll leave it at this, and then we'll jump, as we do on Baltimore Positive, all over the place. I'm going to start with Juwan Howard. But, you know, I was struck, and boy, this is – coming from me, this is so unusual, but I do have to give Senator Ted Cruz some props in that in the midst of the Tucker Carlson, Donald Trump, Mike Pompeo wing of the Republican Party now that appears to be on the side of Russia, Senator Cruz came out and issued a statement saying that he thought he stood with President Biden. And Biden appeared to have it just right. Now, we'll see if Senator Cruz can continue to do that when he gets blowback. But I thought, geez, at least in the short term, someone acted like an adult. So, Brian, shifting gears, you are really tempered on Twitter and Facebook. You choose your words carefully, and I appreciate that. You did not do so over the suspension of Juwan Howard. What was that all about? What struck you? What pricked your nerves about that?
So first of all, I would argue that I did choose my words very carefully in that post. But look, it had less to do with Juwan Howard specifically and more to do.
Well, let's go to the post. Hang on here. Let's not play inside poker. What's the post?
Don?
Something to the effect, I'm going to paraphrase it. I Nestor can probably pull it up. Are you freaking kidding me? Or this is a bunch of crap?
I believe I said this is BS. And I didn't abbreviate it because I don't have
to. I don't know what part's BS. The part where he threw a punch, the part where he got suspended, the part where he didn't get thrown out. Well, what's BS?
So here's what's BS. I was, for those who don't know, I was traveling. I was in Tulsa. And I was sitting in the Waffle House reading the Tulsa World, and there was a column in the paper about how perhaps we should begin to forego the end game players shaking hands because of a cluster of incidents, one of which was Juwan Howard slapping an assistant coach following a game where the players and the coaches were particularly chippy, and my reaction was less about any one particular incident, but the idea that because a couple of adults can't seem to remember what we're supposed, you know, what we learned in kindergarten, which was to keep our hands to ourselves, that we should suddenly forego teaching kids good, you know, and I'm talking about like my kids, but even reinforcing it with teenagers and college students, the idea of good sportsmanship. We hear all the time, this is sports. I understand things get chippy on the field, but if you can't sort of leave it on the court, leave it on the field, and you feel like you can't shake hands with someone without, you know, and let's call it what it is. If you're going to slap someone, it's an assault. You know, if you can't sort of not assault somebody, then maybe just sit on the bench or get up and walk into the locker room and simmer down a little bit. But the idea that we should walk away from teaching people good sportsmanship and expecting everyone to sort of behave like adults at the end of a game, that doesn't seem like the kind of thing that I want to teach. You know, it wasn't what I taught my son, William, who's 23, you know, who's 23 now. And it's not what I'll be teaching, you know, my infant boys.
I thought that is the part, Brian, of the post that resonated with me, is that you reacted to, once again, rather than insist on better behavior, let's just stop doing this. And in other words, since we can't go through a line and shake hands, or at least walk through the line and not shake hands, but just nod, well, therefore we won't do it. And I think what I took from that was just saying, this is just another step towards saying we're not going to have any standards in society. Nestor, you posted a list of 10 or 11 things yesterday that I think speak directly to what Brian's talking about. You said these have been your guiding principles, you know. And
Brian, I bring this to you as a journalist. And again, we came from a completely different place than where Don is, where Don's there protecting the person and doing PR. We're on the other end of asking questions. And I'll tell you, just from a sports perspective, and I've said this out loud, and I'm going to say this personally to John Harbaugh. And I have no problem doing it because I've stood in front of every coach. It's all I've ever done is stand with a notebook in front of a coach after a game, after they've won the big one or lost the big one, and said what happened and been shot at. Right. You know, and from that perspective, coaching etiquette and coaching post game press conferences for coaches making $10 million a year to coach a game, that when you lose said game, taking it out on Jameson Hensley or Jeff Zrebeck or me, because we're the one in the line of fire, is unacceptable in that way, because you're taking that on the fans as well. So I think post-game etiquette for losing, whatever it is, whatever that is, we've really lowered the bar for where the standards were for me 30 years ago, that even when you lose the World Series or you conduct yourself professionally, you know, after the game, whether you're the pitcher, the outfielder, whatever you are. Social media has changed that, but I think Juwan Howard played high school ball, college ball, won championships, played in the NBA. The fact that a guy this far in throws his first post-game punch at this point, I worry a little bit more for him. Like, dude, you're the grown-up, to your point. You're the grown-up here, but I think the decorum of what happens when you lose. Look at what this clown's doing, who lost the election, right? He lost the election, and he literally said, this is what invasions of Ukraine is what happens when cheating. Like this, when you lose, screaming, I didn't lose, or punching someone, or yelling at the media, or whatever that is, it is devolved. It's devolved across not just football, baseball, basketball, it's everywhere, as to what losing represents, and the shame of that, and what a reaction to losing could be.
Brian, I didn't go back and look at comments. What was the tone of the comments to your post?
I think the general tone was sort of along the lines of what you would expect, which is that, you know, people should keep their hands to themselves. I mean, Don, you've known me a long time. I mean, I've tried to never take anything personally. Even when sometimes things got a little chippy on the other side when I asked questions, and I've always, you know, I've always tried to be pretty respectful. I mean, you've dealt with me a lot of years. I mean, how many times have you heard me address people as sir and ma'am? And, you know, I try to remember, you know, like what example I want to set for my kids. And also, you know, is my grandmother in Tulsa going to be disappointed if she hears about it? And she will hear about it.
No, I think that's a great way to put it, Brian.
But what's the penalty then? I mean, we all agree he shouldn't have thrown a punch, right? Or whatever that was. So what happened? Michigan, did he lose his job? Or what happened?
Michigan says the penalty is he's suspended until the end of the season, but can come back for the beginning of the NCAA playoffs. And you know, I think rational minds can debate the appropriateness of that penalty and whether that's enough or not enough. I probably will sidestep that a little bit, but the University of Michigan, I think it worked out to roughly five regular season games.
Yeah, the problem with and again, we're all at a disadvantage because we don't know Juwan Howard. But the problem is this is not his first rodeo. It's not his first altercation. He had that little dust up with Mark Turgeon last year that wasn't a good look. So I'm thinking that he's on somewhat of a short
lease. To your point, as the PR guy, you say it wasn't a good look, right? It's not a good look. It's not a good look to punch the guy, and then it's not a good look to put him back behind the bench, right? Like,
not a good look. But I agree with Brian.
A history professor throwing a punch at a student on the university, you would lose your job. That would just be the end. We wouldn't question whether you're famous or whether you're the best. We would just say you're an educator and you don't punch kids.
Yes. And that's...
And in hockey, we sanction it. In hockey, we give you 5 minutes for it and cheer for you.
Yeah, I think I think you raise a good point. I think that's what Brian and I are saying. It's tough to come down whether it was enough or not enough. People are going to be all over the place. I would say this, that this is two strikes. And I do believe in the three strikes you're out approach. So that if moving forward, Juwan Howard has another incident, then I would be pretty strongly in the camp of, look, you can't do that again. Listen, I like what Brian and I want to jump to the General Assembly. There's a lot to talk about. And in your old beat, Brian, Baltimore County, there's a lot to talk about in terms of maps and what have you. But, I like what Brian's talking about, the civility and the tone in terms of the give and take between reporters and journalists and the folks they cover. Listen, I think in the 20 some years that Brian covered me, I think we may have had, an emotional tone once or twice. I know once I stepped over the line and I don't even remember. And it wasn't my finest moment. And I came back and apologized because I said something that I should not have said when you irritated me. So,
Don, clearly I've let this go because I honestly don't remember.
It was in the council chambers, and we'll talk about it some other time. Let's talk about the General Assembly. I guess we're down now to 5 or 6 weeks to go, Brian. This is your life. You live and breathe it. And again, we are with Brian Sears, outstanding government reporter for the Daily Record. As I said, you live, eat, and breathe this stuff. What's the tone down there now? What's your takeaway? What are going to be the big takeaways from this session?
I think we're still writing that. I mean, we're still watching how the budget is going to play out and where the legislature is going to come down. I think that there's a serious discussion about some tax issues. The General Assembly would like to find a way to help more low-income Marylanders. The governor obviously has a different plan. He really would like this year to make this year that he gets the retiree tax plan, his retiree tax cuts through.
Does that have any chance at all, Brian?
I think the sticking point here is going to be is that, you know, it has a large price tag as you go out. I mean, when you take money out of the general fund and return it to taxpayers, and I'm not saying that that's good or bad or indifferent. I know that there are people who think that that's, you know, who I understand the point of view of both sides. I'll just say that. But the issue is that it does create sort of what I think Fred Homan might tell me is an ongoing expenditure.
Brian, I was going to jump in because I've often said to you, along with really not many more than one or two other reporters, ever truly cared about or understood local government and state government budgets. And what you are about to describe is, and you've heard it for 30 years, and Nestor loves the social studies class part of this, is if you have these one-time windfalls that many state and local governments are having right now as a result of pandemic funding coming its way by the federal government. The conservative middle of the road budgetary approach has always been, we will take that one-time windfall and use it on what we call one-time expenses, usually capital programs, build a new jail, build a new school, build a new community center, because that doesn't create ongoing stress to the budget. Right. If I do it to provide ongoing tax relief, as the governor is suggesting, then down the road, when those funds go away, the next governor.
Well, to bring it to a human side, you know, I got 50 grand laying around. Am I going to invest it? Am I going to build a deck? Am I going to, you know, roll it into future? Am I going to take it to Vegas? You know what I mean? Like, what are you going to do with it? You say they build a deck. They build something tangible that sustains itself to some degree. That's the best way to spend that money.
Right. I mean, because it doesn't cost you additional money down the road. And here's the point. Is that we know based on legislative budget analysis that at the time where we are phasing in the largest parts of the governor's tax plan, it's also the same year that we're starting to phase in the largest portions of the Kerwin public education overhaul. And so it will create some budget tension that might require some cuts. And so the legislature has already been very clear about the fact that Kerwin and public education are a priority. Constitutionally, there's no question. I mean, the one thing that Maryland has to do is go to Annapolis and pass a budget, and that budget has to fund education. And if they do nothing else, they've done their job according to the Constitution.
And it has to be
so
balanced,
I think.
Right, Brian? Has
correct.
To be balanced.
So, correct. Correct. So I think there's some real challenges with that. I think one of the other things that's going to be really interesting to see is whether or not the legislature can pass recreational adult use cannabis this year. I mean, I still think that there are differences between the House and the Senate on how to do this. And the Senate is not super fond of putting it into the marijuana into the Maryland Constitution.
What's the chance of that happening? What's going to stop that, and what's going to make it happen after all these years?
So, look, I mean, we still have the same issues that we were dealing with 4 years ago and 8 years ago. And as Will Smith told me, we've been debating cannabis since 1935 off and on. The same issues are there. You still have issues concerning, you know, racial inequity and who's going to get these licenses and how we're going to treat people who were charged with these crimes that are now suddenly not crimes. And also the issues of public safety, like, How do you handle people who are driving under the influence? Because there's no good way of determining when somebody used because it stays in your system so long. There are all of these issues that still are unresolved. And the General Assembly and that, you know, in the House, they would like to put this into the Maryland Constitution and let Marylanders vote. That could be taken up as early as today. And based on the votes we saw yesterday, you know, I think they've got the votes to pass it out and pass out the constitutional amendment. Whether or not the Senate goes along with that, it, to me right now, is unclear. I mean, so as we stand here today, I mean, I think there's a possibility, but I've also seen this movie with things like sports gaming and know that took 3 years of serious work when they were ready to do it. And so I can't say for sure that we're really there until we're really there.
Has Hogan ever spoken out on this?
Who?
He has not.
Hogan on marijuana.
He has not. We've asked him a number of times, and he's very disciplined. He generally takes very few positions on any bill that hasn't reached his desk yet.
That's why people vote for him.
It's been part of his secret sauce and his 70% approval rating. Brian, a lot of this, and this. We'll get into other issues that you're following. Certainly want to talk about redistricting and what that looks like. But when you talk about shepherding these bills through now, it gets to the current atmosphere in Annapolis and the speaker, good friend of ours, Adrian Jones, and the Senate president, another friend of the show, Bill Ferguson. How would you characterize? We know the relationship that existed between the two mics. They were both bigger than life. How has the relationship evolved in the current atmosphere with Speaker Jones and President Ferguson? And are they on the same page with marijuana?
I will tell you this. I don't think they are on the same page with marijuana. I mean, in my interviews with both of them, I mean, they, you know, the Speaker of the House is very clear about wanting this to go as a constitutional amendment. Bill Ferguson has been very clear with me that he doesn't believe that's necessary, that, you know, more than 60% of Marylanders, according to a Goucher poll in the fall, support the idea of legalizing recreational adult use marijuana. And that if the idea is to just simply put it to the voters for the, you know, for the sake of putting it to the voters, like, they have polls for that, and that's not necessary. He would prefer a straight up or down vote. He also would prefer doing this all in one fell swoop, passing a bill that legalizes it while also passing a framework. I'll be honest with you, my interviews with the speaker, she's less interested in passing a complete framework and putting this in front of voters, and then working the details out after the fact, like we did with sports gaming, and thinks that those initial stages should be enough to get it done and then let the legislature complete its work in future years. So at this point, like, I do not think that they're on the same page. Last year, they were not on the same page on a number of issues such as police reform, such as the climate change bill, such as the sports gaming bill. And a lot of those bills went the way that the House wanted. And there were members of the Democratic caucus who were very angry about the fact that the Senate, in their opinion, the Senate didn't do enough to back Senate positions. Whether or not this puts strain on the presiding officer in the Senate to stand up more for Senate positions and push back a little bit more on the Speaker of the House remains to be seen. You know, but we have also seen them work collegially together. I mean, I think that all you have to do is go back to last year and look at the bill that they worked on with the governor and the two presiding officers that provided some tax relief and some other money for you know, projects that everybody wanted. And you can see that there is the ability to get these kinds of large things done when they want to do them.
Well, if Brian Sears is writing a book and he's got a chapter on the two mics, and he's capturing their styles, and then he transitions to chapters on Speaker Jones and President Ferguson. Describe the styles, now that you've covered them for a couple of years, of Speaker Jones and Senate President Ferguson.
Look, I would tell you that to set the table, the mics were not afraid to throw punches. They were not afraid to have their battles. Certainly, if you look at 2012 and the debate over expanding casino gaming and adding a casino in Prince George's County, Senate President Mike Miller played chicken with the budget and was more than prepared and ultimately did sort of walk away and say, fine, if we can't get this gaming thing done, then I'm not messing with the budget. And, you know, and he's always been willing to say, you know what, I'm happy with next year. If you don't want to do it this year, I'm happy to do it next year. And there was a willingness to sort of play that game and sometimes in the form of bills, hostages were taken. I'm not sensing that sort of, at this point, those sharp elbows, but I still think in some ways that the two presiding officers are still feeling that they're still very new in their positions. And that's why I think this year is going to be a really interesting year, because if the members of the Senate President's caucus feel like the Senate isn't standing up for Senate positions, it could put pressure on a presiding officer and his lieutenants to perhaps throw some of those sharp elbows. We'll see how that plays out.
Are we, Brian, before we jump to the redistricting issue, because I really want to look at that and what it means for folks down there right now. But I think there was some sentiment when we moved on from the two mics that the idea that we would have a speaker and a Senate president forever again, that might have been a relic of the past. As I watch it, I'm not so sure that we're not easing back into a comfort level with the current speaker and the current president, that all of a sudden we're saying, you know what, this thing works, this continuity thing works pretty well. What is your take?
Look, I think, first of all, I'm a very cynical person. I think having been in both of the presiding officers' offices, they're very nice offices. And once you get in there, I mean, I can remember going in and speaking to the Senate president or the Speaker of the House and thinking, you know, these are really nice places to work. And the trappings of the office and the ability to move things through and to in some cases Bigfoot things that you like or don't like, I think that that's hard to give up. I do think that there's a continuity angle. People do like their continuity, even if they say that they would prefer to not have somebody there for 13 or 14 or 35 years. And to be honest with you, once you become presiding officer, there is a tremendous ability to reward your friends and punish your enemies in ways that help you keep your job. Mike Miller was very good at that. If you look at 2018 and the post primary election, I think a lot of people were ready to start writing Mike Miller's obituary. And Mike proved that it's very difficult to unseat him if he doesn't want to go.
Say Tommy Bromwell?
I can.
Going back to the days, so, and it was our famous line: "If you're going to shoot at the king, you better kill the king." Right?
So yeah. So I think. I mean, I think that there's a lot of things in play here. But again, you know, in the end, like people do like continuity. And if you're not, you know, if you are perceived to not be doing a bad job, and if you are not out of step with the people who are electing you, I think it's hard to justify, you know, removing them. And so, you know, like I'm not completely convinced that either one of them is a short term if they don't want to be.
So Judge Battaglia just recently allowed the lawsuit to go forward, challenging the districts that were drawn by the Democrats in Annapolis. How concerned are the Democrats? How do you see this playing out, and how much of a front and center topic is this down there right now?
Openly, I don't think a lot of them are talking about it. I think you have to watch it. I mean, the fact that the judge is allowing this to go forward and allowing most of the challenges to go forward only means that the judge sees that there's a question of law here, and not necessarily that the judge believes that there is necessarily something that would lead to being directly overturned. I think this will be an interesting case, and we're seeing this play out all over the country. We saw it in Texas. We saw it in North Carolina. I think we're probably going. You know, we saw it 2 years ago in Pennsylvania. I think that this is the new norm now, where you're going to see these types of challenges, especially by minority parties, related to how these districts are drawn and how political voices are treated.
Brian, can I ask you, just being on the outside of this, because I think Don and I went down to Annapolis. It was like 2 years ago, a few weeks. We did a thing with the Maryland Hospital Association right before the pandemic happened. Yeah. Pandemic wiped stuff out, obviously created all sorts of governmental strain. We were a part of all that from a Zoom angle, talking to all sorts of people. And then last year was a mess, right? I mean, masks, distancing, Zooming, trying to run the government that way, the insurrection. You know, all of that was going on. How has it been this year in regard to Annapolis and cafes and relationships and all of that stuff that really felt like over the last couple of years? And you talk about the transition at the top and aligning who the political allies are going to be on really touchy subjects like all the ones we've talked about, right? Like where the money goes, marijuana, all these issues. How has the personal part been of this? Because I would think if I were a politician, if I was a 10-year or 3-year politician, wherever it would be, I would see this as I miss the networking part. I miss the hand-to-hand part of this that probably got most of these people elected wherever they're from.
Well, we're operating in an environment where we've lifted some of those restrictions. We're still wearing masks. The General Assembly is still wearing masks on the floor and in the buildings and in the state house. But a lot of the restrictions on visitors have been lifted. Lobbyists are able to move freely through the corridors without being shepherded in and out by staff members. And at least in the Senate, we have for about a week now moved back to in-person, in the committee room, in-person hearings where you can go and physically sit and be present for a hearing and testify in front of a committee. And so, in that respect, it looks a little more like pre-March 2020 as opposed to what we saw last year. But also, I would tell you that I've talked to a number of members, and there is a fatigue that is there, just like there is in with all of our friends and our families, where they would like to get back to the part where they're not wearing masks and things look a little more like pre-pandemic normal than where we are right now.
Well, I felt like last year we're just holding on to the rails. There was no time for relationships or this or that. Certainly no time or ability to have coffee or do those kinds of things. I would just think that there would be a real longing to do even more of that from hey, we've got a restricted amount of time. I'm in Annapolis. I'm from someplace like to be more present. Just in general, that a guy like you buzzing around, I would think you would see more people than even you did 5 years ago, because people would be more apt to be diving in. That's all.
I do. I mean, it's definitely different this year than last year. I would say it's, again, not completely 2020, pre-March 2020, but it is definitely not January through April of 2021.
Great. Brian, last question. We'll let you get out of here and get back to work. You have been beating the drum for years about transparency in government. You and I have probably talked about that issue and are on the same page about that issue more than any other thing we've talked about. How's the state doing in terms of transparency with government for people and reporters?
Not great. To be honest with you, I don't think Maryland has ever done a great job. I think that the laws, Maryland's laws, could be better. But I've said this to you for years. I mean, there's a number of groups that have frequently rated Maryland as in the D range. And that's not to say that some places don't do a really good job. I mean, when I covered Baltimore County, my experiences, I had some unfortunate experiences, but my experiences also were that, there were a lot of times where I asked for things and got them within 6 or 7 hours of writing a request.
Let's be fair here. In all fairness,
sure,
I would often say to you, Brian, you don't need to put it in writing. Just tell me what you need, right? I mean,
sure,
I'll get it for you. I didn't need to go through all that silly.
And a lot of times I can. There's one particular incident that I remember involving the community colleges where I wanted a significant number of documents related to purchasing orders. And because it was the community college, I mean, I think you said to me, can you put it in writing just so if somebody comes to me and asks and says, can I, why did you give it to me? And say, look, they filed a request and under the law, I had to give it to them. And I understand that.
Known to do that occasionally, right? Because I knew an agency or someone would say, what the hell were you doing? And I wanted to say, guys, it is the law. I really should say, guys, we should want to make this available anyway, but it is the law. So you're saying we still have a ways to go in Maryland.
I think the pandemic has exacerbated that, especially in the early days, because the governor's state of emergency orders allowed state and local governments to suspend how they operated related to the Public Information Act at a time when the public really needed transparency because of the lack of physical access to their government.
The lack of trust of the government. I mean, you have the president of the United States intimidating, Georgia pollster. I mean, like this stuff's coming out. We all want to be like, is this thing on the up and up? Is a guy like Brian, is it available to you, right? Like all this information. And there was nobody to pick up the phone on the other end to get you the information in many cases, right?
My concern is always sort of less about me, because I am sort of able to I have resources to some degree. Don will tell you, like, my discussions have always been how does this affect the general public, and I'm sure he could tell you off the air a story about running into me while I walked from 12 different offices with a couple of community activists who were trying to get a look at a map. And Don called us at the end of that and was flabbergasted that we spent 90 minutes and never got to see that map. And I'll tell you, he corrected that issue for them.
Did we not walk right back in there?
We did. So my concern is always how this affects the general public, because the word journalist and reporter never appear in Maryland law related to public records and open meetings. One of the things that I think that we should be thinking about doing is going back and overhauling the old language in the law that makes it more difficult to get things that are more modern. We're seeing that play out right now with the whole Wicker incident with the governor. I think that there are a lot of incidents where the language in the law leaves it open to interpretation about whether or not certain more modern conveniences that would definitely be considered public records are actionable under the law. And so I think a more neutral approach that sort of, explains that all of these things are documents without getting into sort of naming the names, so that people don't read it as an exclusive list rather than sort of examples. I think those are things that we could do. The idea that the governor's office is somehow not subject to, the argument has been made that the governor's office is not subject to certain, records laws. Like, I think I'm not even going to sort of count. I think that's ludicrous. They're a government agency. The idea that a government agency is not, subject to records laws is crazy to me. And the legislature is working on those things, but there's also a lot of agency out there. There are a lot of folks out there that don't want to see these things change. I love what Mike Sanderson does over at the Maryland Association of Counties. But Don, as a former county executive, there are any number of reasons why counties oppose, for example, changing these laws. And a lot of times it's related to costs or perceptions of costs. But I always push back on that and say that the public is paying for these every day with their tax dollars, and these are their records, and the default should always be, where possible, to make these accessible to the public.
Especially in a digital world, right? In a digital world.
Correct. Oh, correct.
100, and there with Nestor and his journalism background, your journalism experience, Brian, I 100% agree and have been an advocate of that from day one. I think we only benefit as a society from that transparency. So, Nestor, once again, we got it from the horse's mouth in the midst of his twins getting ready to create havoc all over the place.
Brian, I don't know what you said about Juwan Howard, but you're either right or you're wrong. I'm really not sure, and I don't even really know if you have a real opinion on it, because you didn't give me one. But I think I felt differently about it at the beginning than I do now. So what have we all learned here together? Don Mahler, former Baltimore County Executive, along with Brian Sears. We're doing it all. We're taking the Maryland Crab Cake Tour back out. And talk about social distancing. I haven't had a crab cake this calendar year. That's a true story. I'm going to be back out on the beat March 4th at Mama's on the Half Shell in Canton. Come on down. I'm going to have some scratch-offs to giveaway as well. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking. Baltimore positive.